The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the August 6th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the Republican elephant. He's sitting on a stool, has his arms crossed, and sort of a, I don't know, put out look on his face. To the right of him, standing on a little block, is Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and she's actually giving the elephant a vaccination. Over on the left side are Fox News' Sean Hannity. He's clapping, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is giving the elephant a double thumbs up. The headline is Giving In to Reality. As Delta swamps red states, Republicans and Fox plead for vaccination. That is our first main story, and we'll start there. Vaccination pressure grows as Delta surges. What happened? Efforts to slow a nationwide Delta variant surge intensified this week as New York City and California announced vaccine mandates for government workers. President Biden prepared to follow suit for federal workers, and a growing number of Republican governors and conservative media figures called on holdouts to get vaccinated. With the highly infectious variant driving outbreaks in red states where vaccination rates have stalled well below 50%, many prominent Republicans urged holdouts to get shots. It's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, said Governor Kay Ivey of Alabama, where COVID hospitalizations more than quadrupled in 3 weeks and just 34% are fully vaccinated. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and former Trump administration spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders all urged holdouts to get what Sanders called the Trump vaccine. House Republican Whip Steve Scalise, eligible for a shot since November, publicly took his own first dose. Fox News aired a public service announcement urging viewers to get vaccinated, and network star Sean Hannity did likewise. I can't say it enough, he said. We don't need any more death. As new daily cases soared over 50,000 a day, both private employers and government began embracing vaccination mandates. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that the city's 300,000 employees must get vaccinated or submit to weekly testing beginning in September, and urged private businesses to mandate vaccination for workers. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced a similar mandate for state employees and the state's 2 million health care workers, and the Department of Veterans Affairs mandated vaccination for its 115,000 health care workers. President Biden was reportedly set to announce a vaccine mandate for all federal employees. The nation faces a pandemic of the unvaccinated, he said. The CDC shifted gears on mask guidelines, recommending that vaccinated people resume wearing masks indoors in hard-hit areas, and that all students and teachers, vaccinated or not, wear them when school resumes. This is not a decision we have made lightly, said CDC Director Rochelle Walensky. The Delta variant is showing every day its willingness to outsmart us. What the editorial said. It's a welcome change to hear prominent conservatives taking a firm stand on the right side of history, said the Los Angeles Times. But we'll stop short of praising these latecomers for taking the high ground after the floodwaters were already rising. If Ivy, DeSantis, and other Republicans had forcefully championed vaccination months ago, they might have helped close a partisan gap that has their state's hospitals deluged with desperately ill COVID patients. The federal government has no business mandating vaccines for the public, but the matter is different for private employers, said the Wall Street Journal. It's an odd libertarian streak that protests government mandates, but then argues that private firms shouldn't be free to set their own workplace rules. With just under half the U.S. population fully vaccinated, increasing that number has taken on more urgency. The FDA could help by expediting full approval of the clearly successful mRNA vaccines. What the columnist said, Republican officials' pro-vaccine turn is no coincidence, said Susan Glasser in NewYorker.com. It's a coordinated political retreat. As of July, counties that voted for Trump had vaccination rates of 35% versus 47% for Biden counties. Republican leaders see the pandemic's alarming new math and have decided they'd rather not take the blame for killing off their own voters. The CDC's new mask guidelines are an extraneous distraction, said Lawrence Gostin in the DailyBeast.com. The unvaccinated will ignore them and continue to spread infection. Vaccine mandates may be politically fraught, but they're the only way to bring freedom from the coronavirus. The CDC should encourage states to enact them for indoor public spaces and help them implement them equitably, while Biden should take the bold step of requiring vaccines for the military and all federal workers. The need to boost vaccination rates has penetrated even some thick and numb Republican skulls, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Still, mandates are fiercely opposed by those on the right who've embraced self-harm as a kind of weird performance ritual. Businesses, universities, and state governments alike should do what they can to persuade the persuadable, imposing inconveniences and both informal and formal sanctions. Think that's un-American? George Washington ordered his troops to be inoculated against smallpox during the Revolution. If more Americans had chosen to be vaccinated, the Delta virus would not have gotten any real traction, said Apoorva Mandavia in the New York Times. Other, perhaps even more dangerous variants are waiting in the wings, and with at least 80 million holdouts keeping us from herd immunity, the U.S. remains highly vulnerable. The unvaccinated will set the country on fire over and over again, and they won't be the only ones who are singed. We're going to read the second main story this week. Harrowing testimony as January 6 investigation begins. What happened? The House Select Committee on the Capitol insurrection this week opened its investigation into one of the most painful and divisive events in recent U.S. history. Hearing testimony from four police officers who defended Congress on January 6th. The officers described in brutal detail how they were threatened, punched, and tasered as supporters of President Trump, fueled by his lies of a stolen election, stormed the building to block the official counting of electoral votes that would formalize President Biden's victory. Capitol Sergeant Aquilino Gunnell said he was more afraid on January 6th than during his entire Army deployment in Iraq. "We fought hand to hand," he said, "inch by inch." Officer Harry Dunn said jeering rioters called him the N-word repeatedly, while Officer Daniel Hodges, seen in a widely shared video screaming as the rioters ripped off his gas mask and crushed him into a doorway, said he feared being lynched by the mob. The committee is composed of seven Democrats and two Republicans, picked by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, both of whom voted to impeach Trump for inciting insurrection. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy initially appointed five Republicans to the committee, but Pelosi vetoed two, Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Jim Banks of Indiana, citing their opposition to the election's certification. Calling the committee a sham, McCarthy withdrew all of his picks. Cheney urged the public to give the hearings their attention. Failing to conduct a full investigation, she said, would mean America risking more violence every 4 years. What the editorial said. Now we know why McCarthy and other Trump loyalists were so determined to thwart, disrupt, and diminish this investigation, said the San Francisco Chronicle. The officer's testimony laid bare the lies spouted by so many Republicans, especially the claim that the insurrection was a mostly peaceful affair. Officer Michael Fanon, who was tasered and beaten unconscious by the rioters, said he was horrified that lawmakers he went to hell to protect are now trying to sanitize January 6 and tell him that hell actually wasn't that bad. Pelosi wants this committee to be a hammer to use against Republicans in the 2022 midterm, said the Wall Street Journal. She made her partisan purposes clear when she broke with House precedent and vetoed McCarthy's appointees. It's true that Representatives Jordan and Banks don't share her view that January 6 was an insurrection or an attempted coup, but if the House Speaker truly believes the evidence for her conclusion is so persuasive, why would she not want to have it tested against the most aggressive critics? What the columnist said, you don't get to investigate a crime you helped commit, said Kurt Bardella in USA Today. Jordan could easily be called on as a material witness. Not only did he take part in a White House meeting in December where Trump allies strategized ways to overturn the election results, he also admitted this week that he spoke to Trump on January 6. On what planet is it rational to let domestic terrorists sympathizers like Jordan serve on a panel that is probing a domestic terrorist event? Top Republicans would like nothing more than to forget about January 6, said Elaine Godfrey in TheAtlantic.com. Both McCarthy and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell claimed they were too busy to watch the first hearing. But that fingers-in-ears approach will be difficult to sustain because Pelosi's Republican picks are taking the investigation very seriously. Cheney claims they will look into every phone call, every conversation, every meeting connected to the attack. Still, I'm not sure who the intended audience might be, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. The minds of most Republicans will not be changed, and everyone else understands that what happened at the Capitol was terrible. The officers cut through all the noise, said Joan Walsh in TheNation.com. They unabashedly called the rioters terrorists and pointed the finger at Trump, with Dunn likening the former president to a person who hires a hitman to do his dirty work. The committee's next steps aren't clear. Will they subpoena Trump to testify? Will they connect any national leaders to the riot? It's impossible to know. But hang on. This investigation has a long way to run yet. The controversy of the week, climate. What a summer of disaster tells us. Apocalypse right now would be an apt title, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, or maybe the day after tomorrow was yesterday. Either way, the summer of climate horror feels like the first vertiginous 15 minutes of a disaster movie. After the hottest June in recorded history obliterated temperature records not only in Death Valley, 130 degrees, but also unusually mild locales like Seattle, 108, and British Columbia, 121, supercharged rainstorms created massive flooding in Central Europe and China, turning streets into raging rivers and killing hundreds. Forest fires are now ravaging Siberia, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest, where Oregon's historic bootleg fire has so far consumed a staggering 400,000 acres of woodland in a blaze so intense it has its own weather system, including lightning storms that start more fires. The inferno has also created a continent-wide plume of smoke, now reddening sunsets and making it hard to breathe as far away as New York. If there's any consolation for this catastrophic summer, said Sophia Andrade in Slate.com, it's that more and more people are becoming concerned with the existential threat that the climate crisis poses. The dire scenarios climate scientists have projected for 2030 or 2040 are already here. In fact, said Andrew Friedman in Axios.com, scientists are now wondering if their computer models of climate change were too conservative by an order of magnitude. The Pacific Northwest heat wave in particular, which killed at least 200 and melted power lines in Portland, Oregon, with mind-blowing temperatures of 116 degrees, was so far from the norm that it's causing experts to reevaluate what's possible. One phenomenon climate models didn't foresee is a stuck jet stream, which instead of moving weather around, locks in rainstorms, hurricanes, heat waves, and droughts for extended periods. Ironically, the Pacific Northwest is where Silicon Valley's millionaires have been buying up property, said Naomi Klein in TheIntercept.com. They figured a warming climate would turn Oregon into something like California in its glory days, while California itself became an arid inferno. Let's hope this summer's horrors shatter that fantasy of safety for all the world's complacent elites. Climate change is here, and nowhere and no one on this planet will be unaffected. With extreme weather events now the norm, said Elin Kelman in the Washington Post, we need to start adapting. Housing should no longer be built in woodsy fire zones, and we need both natural fire and prescribed burns to cleanse forests of dry timber. To limit damage from surging rivers and rising seas, cities must build walls and new drainage tunnels. Places like Portland need to set up cooling shelters to protect the elderly and vulnerable in heat waves. This summer's disasters have added urgency for action. Adaptation has long been a dirty word among eco-activists, said David Wallace Wells in nymag.com. They've seen it as surrender in the fight to decarbonize society and stop the planet from warming. But this summer's freakish showcases of climate horror should expose that as a false choice. Efforts to replace fossil fuels must accelerate dramatically, but it would be criminal to fail to focus on managing climate change now that summer has already become a mass casualty event. We need to help people already suffering and dying in 117 degree heat, biblical floods, and decades-long droughts. The permanent emergency has begun. Here's our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for the wealthy, with new data showing that for every extra $50,000 you manage to accumulate by age 46, your chances of still being alive 24 years later increases by 5%, an association that even holds true of twins and siblings of different levels of wealth. It was a good week for the right stuff after the Federal Aviation Administration issued a formal definition of astronaut that requires not only a trip to space, but demonstrated activities during flight that were essential to public safety or contributed to human space flight safety. And it was a good week for hoes after Facebook agreed to appoint a special human moderator to oversee content on a forum for horticulturists in Western New York, after Facebook had repeatedly deleted the word ho for violating its community standards. But it was a bad week for Olympics cheesecake, after the European Handball Federation fined each member of Norway's women's beach handball team $177 for wearing shorts to the Olympics. Women are required to wear bikini bottoms with a close fit cut at an upward angle. It was a bad week for getting infected after a British study of 12,700 people who've had COVID showed a substantial decline in reasoning, problem solving, and other cognitive abilities. We do not fully understand how, why, or for how long, said researcher Adam Hampshire, but we urgently need to find out. And finally, it was a bad week for self-medication, with news that supply chain shortages of metal and glass may threaten the nation's beer supply. Our brewers have plenty of beer, said Ohio beer distributor Mac McHugh. They just don't have bottles and kegs and cans to put it in. The briefing this week is titled, Bowing to Beijing. Out of fear of losing access to the huge Chinese market, Hollywood film studios are censoring themselves. Why is there tension? Hollywood is under fire from all sides for capitulating to the Chinese government, which demands that all foreign films meet its ideological standards. John Cena, who stars in the 9th Fast and Furious action car chase series, recently apologized to Chinese fans after referring to Taiwan as a country in a promotional video. China considers Taiwan a breakaway province that will inevitably come under its control. I'm very sorry for my mistake, Cena groveled while speaking in Mandarin. Sorry, I'm really sorry. Fans of the original Top Gun have noticed that in the upcoming sequel, the flag of Taiwan that was on Tom Cruise's jacket has disappeared. And in the credits of its 2020 live-action Mulan remake, Disney thanked local officials in Xinjiang, where China runs brutal re-education camps for Uyghur Muslims and has been accused of genocide. Instead of us doing business with China and that leading to China being more free, said Director Judd Apatow, what has happened is that China has bought our silence with their money. When did this begin? China began opening its cinemas to overseas movies in the mid-1990s, creating a huge financial opportunity for American studios willing to play by the rules. In 1997, Disney released Martin Scorsese's Kundun, a biopic of the 14th and current Dalai Lama that depicts China's 1950 invasion and annexation of Tibet and the Dalai Lama's subsequent exile in India. Chinese officials who claimed they liberated Tibet were infuriated. Disney boss Michael Eisner harbored dreams of opening theme parks in Hong Kong and Shanghai, so he enlisted Richard Nixon's one-time China emissary, Henry Kissinger, to smooth tensions. Eisner also personally apologized to Chinese officials, calling the release of Kundun a stupid mistake. Eisner got his theme parks, and Disney returned to Chinese cinemas in 1999 with the animated and inoffensive Mulan. Scorsese's films, meanwhile, were banned from China for more than a decade. Hollywood has tiptoed carefully around sensitive topics ever since. How are films being altered? In a report last year, Made in Hollywood Censored in Beijing, the free speech organization PEN America accused industry decision makers of changing the content, casting, plot, dialogue, and settings of films to to avoid antagonizing Chinese officials. At first, studios only tweaked their Chinese releases. For example, when censors ordered that dirty laundry be removed from Shanghai balconies in Mission Impossible 3. But soon studios began removing potential sore points from their U.S. releases. The 2012 remake of Red Dawn originally depicted a Chinese invading army, but so as not to offend Beijing, they were digitally altered to become North Korean troops in both the U.S. and Chinese releases. China's government allows only 34 foreign films to be released each year, and studios competing for those valuable slots fear being denied access to 1.4 billion people, the world's largest box office market. Over time, writers and creators don't even conceive of ideas, stories, or characters that would flout the rules because there is no point in doing so, the Penn Report said. What else are studios doing? To appeal to Chinese audiences, Hollywood has shoehorned popular Chinese actors into films and blatantly placed the popular milk drink Gu Li Duo in the Chinese release of Iron Man 3. In another strategy, studios are co-producing films with Chinese movie-making houses to evade the foreign film quota. The Meg, a 2018 thriller about a shark-like dinosaur in modern times, was co-produced by Warner Brothers and a Chinese studio. Jiang Wei, one of its Chinese producers, called the film suitable for co-production as it doesn't involve many cultural, educational, or national issues. Media conglomerate Dalian Wanda sought to buy up American studios before the pandemic in what its founder openly admitted was an effort to wield Chinese soft power. The company still owns Legendary Entertainment, the California studio behind the upcoming Dune remake. Both Republicans and Democrats have called for legislation to lessen China's influence over Hollywood. A bill introduced by Representative Mike Gallagher, the Republican from Wisconsin, would require all Hollywood studios to disclose whether a film has been changed to fit the demands of the Chinese Communist Party. Will the bill pass? Probably not in the immediate future. But despite its efforts to appease Beijing, Hollywood may lose much of its box office in China anyway. Stanley Rosen, a political scientist who studies the Hollywood-Beijing relationship, said China's growing film industry is now making so many movies, more than 1,000 in 2019, that it is squeezing foreign films out of the market. February's Detective Chinatown 3, a Chinese-made heist comedy, pulled in $424 million on its opening weekend in China, the biggest opening of all time in a single market. In 2020, Chinese-made films captured 80% of the country's box office, according to the Hollywood Reporter, and all 10 top-grossing films in China last year were made there or in Hong Kong. China has learned enough from Hollywood to make its own films, Rosen said. And we'll move into a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Biles Deserves America's Admiration. What kind of champion withdraws at the Olympics? Asked Lindsay Krause. One who has the courage to admit to the world that she's human. Simone Biles, the best gymnast America has ever produced, withdrew from the competition in Tokyo this week after realizing she was not in the proper mental state to perform her dangerously acrobatic routines, leaving her at risk of serious injury. Predictably, some of her critics attacked her as weak, a typical Gen Z slacker who had let her teammates and country down. But Biles, who survived a difficult childhood and sexual abuse by the U.S. gymnastic team's monstrous team doctor, Larry Nassar, actually helped her team by ignoring ego. A poor performance told her she'd lost the confidence necessary to control her body while flying and tumbling through the air. So she stepped back to cheer for her teammates. Like tennis star Naomi Osaka, Biles has performed a valuable service by revealing her vulnerability and pushing back against the narrative of victory at all costs, including mental and physical health. As Biles said, there's more to life than gymnastics. Even the world's best athletes are not superhuman. We have no right to expect them to be. Why leaving Afghanistan is a mistake. Accepting unconditional defeat in Afghanistan is a choice, and a bad one, said Jonah Goldberg. As Taliban fighters take growing control of the country, President Biden has dismissed all concerns about what that will mean by citing cliches about forever wars that can't be won. The national bipartisan fatigue over the war, complete withdrawal was initiated by former President Trump, is understandable. But the truth is that it ceased being a war a long time ago. Our limited presence of 2,000 U.S. troops was a counterterrorism operation that incurred very few casualties. It successfully kept the Taliban from toppling the Afghan government and protected the millions of girls, women, and other Afghans our intervention liberated from theocratic tyranny. Now we're abandoning these people to widespread executions, rapes, beatings, and other horrors. And despite what Trump and Biden have contended, it's not hard-headed realpolitik that to surrender a major airbase and allied government in a volatile part of the world. Giving up in frustration hands anti-American extremist a great political victory that will diminish the U.S. as a global power. That's not strategic, nor was it inevitable. This is an international column from Iran. Arabs suffer a man-made drought. With their wetlands drying up and their cattle dying of thirst, the Arab minority in Iran's Khuzestan province is taking to the streets in desperation and rage, said Golnaz Madavi. The region has been suffering a punishing heat wave that has sent temperatures soaring to 122 degrees. Yet the protests are about more than climate change-induced disaster. Khuzestan was once one of Iran's most water-rich provinces. But following the construction of the Karkay Dam in 2001, water was diverted from Arab-populated areas near the Iraqi border to industrial sites and neighboring regions. The Arabs believe the Persian-dominated government targeted them on purpose, stealing their water to force them to flee to Iraq. "You have dried up our land," demonstrators are shouting, "to force us to emigrate." Their protests have been peaceful because they didn't want to invite violent crackdown. Violence has found them anyway. Security forces have killed at least 8 protesters and bystanders since mid-July. But don't expect the Arabs to give up. Iranian authorities have always kept order in Khuzestan by giving privileges to the sheikhs who head the local Arab tribes. With even the sheikhs now joining the protest, bribery has failed, and the unrest will continue. We're on the page for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, "A Death on the Border." Rosario traveled from El Salvador to Texas to provide a better life for her daughter, Adriana, said Molly Hennessy Fisk in the Los Angeles Times. Adriana found her way to safety. Her mother did not. Black feathers fell from circling vultures and snagged at the matted yellow grass. The ranch manager eyed the terrain and followed the stench. He found the woman's body, like so many others in the South Texas brush, splayed in the weeds, arms dark with decay, raised above her head as if in surrender. The rancher knew what to do. He had come upon 15 such migrants over the years. He called Brooks County Sheriff's dispatcher. They issued a code 500, a dead body call, summoning a deputy, two Border Patrol agents, and a justice of the peace, and a funeral director. They met the rancher shortly before noon at the gate of the Los Palos Ranch, about 75 miles north of the border. Together they waded through knee-high thorny weeds, mindful that the June heat rouses rattlesnakes from their burrows. The men gazed down where she lay, face gone, skull picked clean by scavengers, hair and lower jaw dragged a few feet from the body, not yet skeletal. They guessed the woman had died of exhaustion or dehydration. They wait over there and move at night, said the rancher, pointing to a nearby stand of mesquite, where he and his wife sometimes spy the passing shadows of those heading north. The deputy wrapped the body in a white sheet. He then lifted it into a gray bag and helped the funeral director load it into the back of his Ford Explorer for transport to the sheriff's morgue. It would be fingerprinted and tested for coronavirus. The men found no trace of a name. It would be days before the fingerprints told investigators that the woman was Rosario Yanira Giron de Orellana, a 41-year-old single mother who had traveled more than 1,500 miles from El Salvador. Brooks County and the Rio Grande Valley to the south have been popular smuggling routes for decades, a reliable barometer of migrant deaths border-wide. 6 months into 2021, deaths in the county had already reached 55, up from a total of 34 last year and above the five-year average. Migrants here often dial 911 from their cell phones, stranded without water and begging for help. Some days this summer, officials recovered three bodies. Agents and deputies do what they can to patrol suspected smuggler drop-off and pickup spots, including County Road 107, the road closest to where Rosario's body was found, a mile-long stretch that dead-ends at Los Palos Ranch. Migrant advocates have placed more than 150 blue barrels of water on County Road 107 and other local highways, but Rosario was discovered miles from the road, beyond sight of the barrels. She had been found without a purse, phone, passport, or other identification. Her black hair was cinched in a blue scrunchie. Her black striped shirt was pulled up to reveal a pink lace bra above black pants. Smugglers often instruct migrants to dress in black. Good camouflage at night, but brutally hot after sunrise. The deputy checked her pockets. Nothing. She wore no jewelry, just a plastic rosary and a string of rainbow beads with a medallion that said, in Spanish, Virgin, please guide my path. What is the time? Asked one of the Border Patrol agents. It was 12:16 p.m. The Justice of the Peace pronounced Rosario dead. Once the funeral director drove the body to the morgue, agents photographed her blackened fingers, hoping to identify prints. They sent a picture of her left thumbprint to the Salvadoran consulate. A match came back the next day. The daughter of a farm worker, Rosario grew up in the coastal town of San Julian, population 22,000, about 40 miles west of the capital. She was slender, shorter than 5 feet tall, the second of nine siblings, some of whom described her as a second mother, a homebody they nicknamed Chaito. Devout but headstrong, Rosario celebrated her quinceañera not with a party, but by reciting the rosary with friends and family at home. She loved her namesake, roses, but rarely received them. Married at 21, she had a daughter, Adriano Oriana de Giron. Then in recent years, she separated from her husband and moved back home. Rosario seldom went out. She mainly went to church, where she taught catechism classes. Rosario raised not only her daughter, but her siblings, nieces, and nephews. She took them to school, church, and a local park, helped with their homework, and put them to bed. She watched most of them depart for the U.S. and settle where her father had before he was deported 11 years earlier, Houston. Rosario never spoke of migrating, but in November she celebrated her daughter's quinceañera, buying her a sleeveless aqua dress and speaking eloquently about her passage into womanhood. Privately, her sister said, Rosario worried that Adriana had grown old enough to be targeted by gangs that ruled the neighborhood. When she would call me, I would tell her, the life is very different here, recalled Rosario's older sister, Maria Hueso, 42, whose daughter, also named Adriana, will celebrate her quinceañera in the fall. Here there is work, but you have no time for your kids. There you are with your kids, but there is no work. Hueso had crossed the border illegally about 20 years earlier. She didn't feel she had the right to tell anyone else not to come, but none of the family had traveled north on foot. They had all been caught soon after crossing the Rio Grande, and none had arrived since President Trump was elected and cracked down on asylum seekers. I never imagined Rosario would come, Hueso said. To decide to take this path, you have to be brave. And she never went out of the house. She didn't know how to defend herself in the street, in the world. On March 16th, about 6 a.m., Rosario said goodbye to her mother and caught a ride with her daughter north. It would take them 15 days, moving from town to town before they reached the Mexican border city of Reynosa. Rosario knew from talking to other migrants that if she crossed the border with Adriana, the Border Patrol would send them back to Mexico due to pandemic restrictions. But if Adriana went without an adult, she would be released to relatives in Houston. Rosario's younger sister, Vilma Giron, 38, had made the same journey in 2014. She was detained by the Border Patrol, released after a few months, and sent for her two daughters. They all claimed asylum. The 17-year-old was entering the seventh grade. The 21-year-old had graduated high school and was working at an Amazon warehouse, where she would soon qualify for tuition assistance to study at the University of Houston. That is why she came, Giron said of Rosario over a recent breakfast of pupusas. That is why we all did it, for our children. We never thought this would happen to us. Where we live, there are so many families who have come. All of them. Rosario didn't tell her daughter that she was sending her across the border alone until they parted on April 2nd. She arranged for a fellow migrant mother traveling with the group to pick Adriana up. When the woman arrived, Rosario took the girl aside. We have to separate, Adriana recalled her mother saying. It's better for you. We will reunite. God bless and keep you. There would be about 10 migrants in the group, all eligible to enter the U.S. because they were either mothers with young children or youths like Adriana without their parents. Thin, shy, and small for her age, Adriana didn't know how to swim, but she followed the other migrants onto the inflated raft and crossed the Rio Grande. They were soon detained by the Border Patrol. Adriana was held for several weeks, then was released to her family in Houston with permission to stay until her asylum case was decided. Meanwhile, Rosario had crossed the border to a smuggler's stash house in the Rio Grande Valley, where she stayed for a couple of weeks before heading with a group to Houston. She had a Salvadoran cell phone and sent WhatsApp messages to her daughter via her brother in San Julian. Don't worry, daughter. We are good, she wrote at 8 p.m. on May 26. We walked 2 days and 2 nights, and we are in a place where we can rest. The messages suddenly stopped. Days later, Rosario's sister, Vilma Giron, started receiving WhatsApp messages from a stranger with a Salvadoran number who claimed to have migrated with Rosario. Oscar C. said that when Rosario stopped walking on a ranch May 29th, fellow migrants left her behind with water and a cell phone. He said she was tired, but her health seemed okay, Giron said. She was waiting there for immigration to find her. Rosario's relatives were initially afraid to contact U.S. authorities because many of them had entered the country illegally. Instead, they phoned the South Texas Human Rights Center, which distributes water barrels and fields calls from families searching for missing migrants. Volunteers agreed to help them search and relayed information to the Border Patrol. One of Rosario's brothers and a nephew, Huezo's son, both of whom were in the country legally, traveled from Houston to Brooks County to search for her June 3rd. Huezo texted Oscar for more information, and he responded that Rosario was at the edge of a sandy street in front of a ranch. What did she have with her? Huezo asked. Her documents and her phone, Oscar said, noting that the phone was turned off so that it had a battery. The next day, Oscar sent Huezo a Google Maps location for Rosario. She forwarded the coordinates to her son in Brooks County. He and his uncle got within 2 miles of where Rosario's body was later found, but were stopped by a local ranch gate. Nearby, they saw discarded shoes and water jugs. Later, Huezo messaged Oscar again. "What else did my sister have other than a black shirt and pants?" she asked. "What kind of shoes did she wear?" "Gray shoes with pink on the outside," he replied. Huezo had seen a photo of Rosario taken just before she left for the U.S., in which she wore gray and pink Nikes. "When I saw that," Huezo said of Oscar's message, "I knew it was my sister." She tried to send Oscar more questions. He never answered. The next day, investigators notified Huezo that they had identified Rosario's body. She went to her sister's house to tell Adriana. "All she had to do was see me," Huezo recalled. Rosario's family let her daughter decide where she would be buried, El Salvador or the U.S. Adriana wanted her mother nearby where she could visit the grave. Huezo and two brothers, between shifts at McDonald's, built an altar to Rosario encircled by votive candles and the roses she had loved in their double-wide trailer. They recited the rosary for 9 nights, the traditional novena, and they helped their parents apply for humanitarian visas from the U.S. government to attend her funeral June 29th. The visa requests were denied. Instead, Rosario's parents watched the funeral mass on Facebook Live. A priest they didn't know spoke about the daughter he had never met at a church they had never seen. Relatives wore white T-shirts embossed with black rosaries, and a quote, "Today we take different paths, but I will always take with me what I learned from you." Adriana stood beside her mother's grave in sneakers and a pleated black skirt. She sobbed as the casket was lowered, embracing a young uncle, one of many relatives her mother had raised. The rain stopped. The family released a white string of balloons shaped like a rosary. A guitarist played Spanish Christian pop songs, and some sang along, their voices soon drowned out by the hum of an earth mover. They had already affixed a temporary metal plaque to the grave labeled Rosario. Last week, Adriana selected her mother's headstone, gray granite with two vases attached for her roses. It will be installed by next month, around the same time Adriana starts 9th grade. A version of this story originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times. And we're over on the Talking Points page. Looks like we have time for a couple of articles. Start with Barrick, the foreign influence over Trump. Crooks and spies flock to former President Trump like moths to a corrupt flame, said Casey Michael in NBCNews.com. That's the clear message from the charges filed last week against billionaire businessman Tom Barrack, Trump's close friend and chairman of his 2016 inaugural committee. Barrack's side hustle, federal prosecutors say, was manipulating Trump on behalf of the United Arab Emirates, who invested more than $1.5 billion in Barrack's private equity firm. Barrack, 74, had been accused of adding language to Trump's speeches praising the UAE, of asking Emirati officials for a wish list of U.S. policy changes, and of promoting this corrupt dictatorship in the U.S. without disclosing he worked for them. Barrack denied any wrongdoing, but the evidence against him is damning. He allegedly carried a dedicated phone for communicating with his Emirati associates, and in one text referred to the UAE as the home team. Barrack posed a clear threat to national security, said Christina Wilkie in CNBC.com. The main espionage charge he faced is used to prosecute spies such as Russian agent Maria Butina. Barrack allegedly used his close relationship with Trump to penetrate the White House and pass details from internal discussions to his UAE contact. Barrack accomplished concrete goals for the UAE, including pushing Trump to scuttle a 2017 summit with American, Emirati, Saudi, and Qatari officials that the UAE opposed. Throughout the presidency, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, Trump could scarcely have been more accommodating to the Emirates and its ally, Saudi Arabia. Just as they hoped, he ended the Iran nuclear deal and blocked Congress' attempt to pull U.S. military support from the Saudis and UAE conducted in Yemen, from the war they conducted in Yemen. Trump also provided cover for the Saudi crown prince after the murder of Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi. And not incidentally, it was Barrack who recommended that Trump hire Paul Manafort as his campaign manager. Americans have Trump scandal fatigue, said Dennis Aftergut in TheBulwark.com. But think about it. Barrack joins a half dozen close Trump associates who have been indicted, like Manafort and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who were convicted and pardoned by Trump. Barrack has been accused of secretly working for foreigners while advising Trump on foreign policy. Only the best people, right? Air rage, insults, and punches at 30,000 feet. The friendly skies have gotten more unfriendly, said Jorge Fitzgibbon in the New York Post. Airlines have seen a surge of violence and hostility from their customers this year, with Federal Aviation Administration reporting more than 3,600 unruly passenger incidents since January 1st, and a 500% increase in incidents serious enough to merit investigation. In recent months, a Sarasota, Florida woman spat on other passengers after being told to wear a mask. One flight attendant had two teeth knocked out by a woman passenger. Flight attendants appear to be bearing the brunt of passenger aggression, said Elena Achter and TheInsider.com. They say they face daily cursing, insults, and threats of violence that are taking a toll on their mental health. It seems that everybody is angry at everybody 24/7, said Colleen Burns of the Association of Flight Attendants. Pandemic fatigue appears to be a major factor, said Ben Baldanza in Forbes.com. After a year of restrictions, many passengers resent the new rules of commercial air travel. Some, for example, become enraged when a flight attendant tells them to put a mask on a young child. Others try to evade mask rules by eating for the entire flight. On a plane, everyone experiences a loss of control, and it can trigger rage in people who already feel their rights and freedom are being violated. It doesn't help that airlines treat coach passengers like cattle, said Robert Sapolsky in CNN.com. In response to violent incidents, many airlines have removed alcoholic beverage service on domestic flights for the low-born vulgar ruffians in the main cabin, but not for the first or business class. A 2016 study found a far greater risk of air rage on planes in which boarding coach passengers must walk past the first-class seats. Air rage is part of a bigger problem that can also be seen on highways and daily life, said Helene Olin in the Washington Post. After a year of isolation and trauma, we've become more self-centered and antisocial, and we are experiencing a moment of collective rage as we struggle to readjust to society. Before getting on a plane, I suggest that you take deep breaths. Leave your politics off the plane. Let's give each other the benefit of the doubt. On the poll watch, 62% of Americans say they would get a booster shot if it was made available. 18% would not. 20% are unsure. We'll finish the show today with a quote from biologist E.O. Wilson, who says, "The real problem of humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.